Yeah, after working on that brigade staff as the assistant S2 for a couple of months, January, February, probably about March, I went back to 1st Battalion 8th Cav as the S2.
And where were you located then?
And then we were down in down at 3 Corps. I'm trying to think. I can't think of the name of the place where we were. It was south of Tain Inn.
Uh-huh.
And the battalion was involved with these riverine operations.
Okay, can you describe
that was? Yeah, it was rivers, along the rivers. It was in conjunction with the Navy river boats.
Mm-hmm.
And we would provide combat troops, and the Navy provided the boats. And they would just run up and down. They were called riverine operations. Run up and down the rivers and drop troops off. Of course, as a battalion, the staff officer, I never got out on any of the boats participating in that. I always sat around the battalion headquarters monitoring most of the activity.
But men from the battalion's operation.
But our combat troops would load on these riverboats with the Navy operating the boats, and they would run up and down the rivers and waterways, right there close to the Cambodian border.
And you were still an intel officer.
I was the intel officer, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now at the lower level, back down at the battalion level.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my intel at that point, you know, is what I could find on the ground, feedback up, but most of the intel was coming back down to me from the brigade level.
Okay. What kinds of things did operational forces find that you as an intel officer had to pass on up the chain?
When they would make contact with enemy units, if they had any KIAs or and covered, in their bunker complexes, if they captured any kind of documents, maps, anything of that nature, they would pass that back, collect it, pass it back, send it back to us, and then we would collect it and pass it back up the brigade and all to get interpreted where the interpreters were.
Okay.
We had the interpreter at our battalion, but there was just one. So, you know, you could decipher some things for us, give us look at it, give us immediate
feedback
uh-huh. right there.
Uh-huh.
But the in-depth analysis and all took place at higher levels than we did.
Frank, were you enjoying this work or did you not love it as much as you might?
The staff work, no. You were kind of stuck there sitting, in this bunker mostly all day, and there's very little places to go. You're kind of limited. All this action's going on, and other troops are involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more paperwork, yeah.
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 Did you sort of wish that you could be out in the field again?
Yeah, I did. And I would get on a helicopter and just ride out there once in a while, just talk to the ground commanders, just to be out there with them.
At some point, Frank, did you go on an R&R?
Yeah, I went R&R. During the year, I can't remember exactly when.
Uh-huh. Where'd you go?
But I did go on R&R that time. Of course, I was married, so I met my wife in Hawaii.
Okay.
This time.
For a week, or?
For a week.
Uh-huh.
We spent that there, a time there, and enjoyed dining and just touring the island.
Uh-huh. Was it a good idea to go on R&R?
This was harder.
It was harder, uh-huh.
When I went back, I cried.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like tearing me apart to have to go back over there and leave her. You know, and of course she was hurt too.
Yeah, I'm sure she was. In general, do you think it was just not a good idea to
I don't think so. I think I don't think it was all that good of an idea, yeah.
Because
it put you through some turmoil. It would have been better just to stay there or, just gone somewhere by myself maybe.
Yeah. Frank, let's take a break for a minute. Frank, you mentioned that you were S2 for riverine operations by the first of the eighth. Was that an area where Agent Orange was being used?
I don't know. I know Agent Orange was used in the Central Highlands.
Okay.
My first tour, it was used in the northern part. When you moved down there in the 4 Corps, there was a lot of, the rice paddies, small villages here and there. There was still pretty heavy jungle.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall Agent Orange being used in that jungle.
Okay, so...
That was big stuff.
Did you yourself ever have exposure to Agent Orange that you know
of? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I remember seeing C-130s flying over, just spraying this stuff right over top of us. And also, you know, operating in areas that was brown, that had been sprayed.
How fast did that stuff work?
I think it took a couple of days if we could see any effect. Maybe a day, 24 hours or something like that.
But you actually remember being underneath a
Yeah. Well, you know, the ironic thing was you could fly over from the helicopters and look down, and you could see the big brown swaths down there. And then you would get on the ground, and, I mean, everything was green and lush underneath it.
Oh, okay.
So it didn't, you know, it didn't leave the landscape barren. Maybe in the farming areas where, you know, they grew rice, if you sprayed it there, it would wipe out the crops and stuff. But boy, in that jungle.
Didn't penetrate all the way through
it did.
The canopy?
Yeah. No, it wouldn't come all the way through.
Okay. How long were you actually with the first of the eighth as an S2?
S2, let's see. I got there and, probably from early March, April, May, June. About June, I think, is when I left the battalion.
Okay, and so, where did you go? Is that the point at which you went home?
That's the point I returned home, yeah.
Okay. How did it happen that you went home at that time?
Okay, the battalion was in operations, and my wife, you know, it only spent about 6 months was, well, she got pregnant when I came to Vietnam, so, and she had delivered a baby, but she was having health problems with our son.
I see,
He wasn't responding neurologically or physically to nourishment or anything like that. And there were several things that she was worried about. And I know we exchanged letters for a couple of times because he was born in March. And I remember getting a letter from her, or not a letter, it was actually just a message that came through. Somehow she got a message through, and it came over our radios that I had a son born. That was kind of neat.
I'll bet.
That was really neat, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyhow, then the follow-on letters indicating there was something wrong, without knowing what exactly. And she became more and more worried and everything until I guess she finally, the doctor said, you know, it's time to get your husband home because this is a pretty serious condition.
Yes, sir.
He's failing to thrive, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so I got a message, you know, through the Red Cross. They processed that and said to pull me back early, about a month, about 2 months early.
Mm-hmm.
And I returned home under those kind of conditions, too. And our son was, you know, he died at about 2 years old, a little over 2 years. But before that period of time, he was in and out of the hospitals, and he was undiagnosed. Whatever condition he had was undiagnosed. He just died of heart failure was what caused the final death.
And were you living in Florida at this time? Or?
Let's see. Yeah, she was in Florida. But, no, I was at Fort Benning.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So my orders that when I came back to the stateside was sent me to Fort Benning, put me in the Infantry Officer Advanced Course, and I remained at Fort Benning and as OCS Company Commander. And during this whole time, we had this, you know, our son in the hospital, field hospital, and everything was right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Army hospital, base hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we had to evacuate him. You know, he had to go to Walter Reed. They checked him there to see if they could analyze or determine what might be happening, and they wasn't able to do anything either. And he finally died there at Fort Benning, and we buried him there.
Sir, did you ever think that that some service-related exposure might have been an agent in his death?
Yeah, I said maybe Agent Orange, because, you know, I had been to Vietnam the first tour and had been exposed, and I thought maybe Agent Orange, but when I put in a claim, it was denied.
When did you put in that claim?
When I got out of the Army.
Okay.
When they evaluated me for Agent Orange-related conditions and stuff.
Which would have been roughly when?
In 1983.
Okay,
And, you know, up until that point, I hadn't done anything. But I brought that up at that point, you know, undiagnosed, you know, that maybe it was Agent Orange-related, but then it got turned down, so I never pushed it.
Do you still think that might have been a factor?
In the back of my mind, I'm thinking it could have been.
Yeah, you just don't have enough evidence.
Because if some things happened to me medically, my condition, I remember having rashes, breaking out in rashes in stateside and getting high fevers, and I'd go in and just, I wouldn't be diagnosed. And I'd have these hives all over me, and I'd get feverish and sick, you know, and then go to the hospital, and they'd give me Benadryl treatment and everything, and pretty soon it would go away, and then I would recur, you know, that time and again.
Mm-hmm.
But that was early, not, you know, and I'd have these high fevers and things.
Just unexplained?
Unexplained. You know, and they would say, well, you obviously you must have come, you know, you're allergic to something, you know. So I kind of think maybe it was a reaction to that. I'm not sure. Because, I mean, we sat there, and I know we ate food, you know, that would have been contaminated by Agent Orange, because we'd open our rations and be in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we may have ingested it. And I remember it happening to me one time over there, you know, getting rashes, hives, again, not being able to explain what caused it.
Hmm. How do you feel about the Veterans Administration and how it's handled servicemen who have advanced claims around Agent Orange? Not specifically your own, but in general.
I think they're doing okay. They're doing what they can.
Uh-huh.
I mean, their hands are tied too by budget and everything. I think they've been pretty fair.
If more resources were devoted to the Veterans Administration, do you think you'd have better outcomes for service?
Maybe, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but how much, you know, again, it's an expense involved. And they're pretty good. I mean, now, just service in Vietnam, you know, assumes exposure to Agent Orange. At first, you had to say where you were, what day you were there, and, you know, and everything.
Uh-huh.
Now, you just serve. They automatically. And if you have a medical condition, you know, that's related that they've identified. So I think, all in all, that they've done what they could.
Have you been asked to participate in any studies around Agent Orange exposure?
No.
Okay. Sir, you said that when you came back to the States, although you had this, you know, family crisis going on, you were also a company commander for the OCS at Fort Benning.
Fort Benning, yeah.
Uh-huh. How long did you actually stay there?
2 years.
Okay.
2 years.
And, again, you were in an instructor role, or what were your...
Well, no, it was commanding the company, so in the OCS company, it's kind of different. These are young people aspiring to be officers. They're, in, you know, ex-NCOs. A lot of them were college graduates who
mm-hmm.
Came in under what's called the college option program. And this, okay, when I was there, we were just at the end of the Vietnam War buildup.
Yes, sir.
In 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So they were phasing down, you know, because they had like, let's see, two battalions of OCS or three battalions of them,
mm-hmm.
maybe something like 15 companies of students. And when I got there, we had narrowed down to one battalion and five companies. And they had given most of the candidates to whittle them down, and, you know, in his drawdown, sudden drawdown, they offered the candidates an honorable discharge out of the Army. If you want to quit OCS and take his discharge, it's yours.
With no service?
No service obligation. So a lot of people just, you know, took off. They took that option.
Go ahead.
Then those that remained, you know, were the ones who wanted to continue to pursue a career in the Army.
Mm-hmm. With less of a thought to their service in Vietnam and more of a thought to a career.
More thought to career. They were more dedicated to serving. Yeah.
Okay. How did you feel during that drawdown period? Were you glad that the United States' involvement in Southeast Asia was appearing to come to an end? Or
yeah, that it was getting over with.
Uh-huh.
At that point, yeah, it was really wearing us down. I mean, it was and, you know, the justification for the war, everything was in question. So.
Right. Did you give much thought to the national debate about whether the United States should be involved in Southeast Asia?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were watching that more uh-huh. and more, I think, and that, you know, as time went on.
How did you feel about the job that President Nixon was doing with managing the war?
That's hard to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated time period.
It's complicated, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I can't really.
Okay. Your service to the Army, though, continued after you left Fort Benning,
uh-huh.
I presume. Where did you go next?
From Fort Benning, I moved to Fort Monroe on the training and doctorate. Oh, wait, no, I went from there to complete my college degree.
Well, where'd you go to school then?
in University of Nebraska at Omaha.
And why there?
That they participated in this bootstrap program. They were one of the schools. So what I had been doing is getting my college credits by night school.
Okay.
Up to where I had enough credits for 3 years, and so I submitted those transcripts to University of Nebraska at Omaha, who were, you know, participating in the bootstrap program.
Can you describe that program generally?
It's 1 year. You get to go to school,
mm-hmm.
in residence to obtain a degree. And so they accepted all the, you know, hit and miss, the, you know, from the different colleges and universities of all the undergraduate courses to make sure I had prerequisite three years worth, and I
right.
could complete my degree in 1 year. And when they accepted me, then up with that letter of acceptance, I applied to the Army to release me on an administrative leave for that year. And went, you know, to school full time.
So you were there in what, 1970?
College student, 1971.
To 72?
And graduated in January 1972, yeah.
Okay. What was the climate like on the campus there?
Well, it was pretty anti-military.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. And I know there would be some classes we'd go to, sociology classes and stuff like that. And the younger students,
mm-hmm.
you know, in college would look around, you know, the hippie-type generation.
Right.
And, of course, there were a lot of us there, military, ex-military, you know, with straight haircuts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were easy to identify as, I don't know what they call them, bootstrappers.
Right.
But these kids would come into a class, we'd get assigned, and they'd look around and get up and just walk out.
Really?
Because they knew, number one, that, you know, we would set a high curve.
Because you were there.
We were there to study.
Right?
We weren't there to play around, you know,
right.
and have fun. Our job, we were strictly there to learn what we could, get our degree. And, you know, we competed with each other there, you know, best grades and all that kind of stuff like we have in all the service schools. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's a competitive type environment.
Right. Did you ever see any anti-war protests on the campus or around
there? No, none I ever saw, no.
Okay.
Just that kind of thing. They just didn't, you know, the younger students kind of stayed away from us, didn't mingle with us.
Well, and you weren't all that old at this point.
And we weren't really that old because, what, about 30-some years old by then?
Yeah,
we
not even, yeah.
Yeah, and these kids are, you know, 19, 20 years old.
Right, right.
Still that, we still had that military air about us, so.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you guys kind of club around together?
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go out to dinner, you know, we had our social events and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just for us.
Did you enjoy that year?
Yeah, that was really a unique year.
Okay.
And it was very relaxed, you know, because no uniform, just go to school for 4 hours a day, 6 hours a day.
And manage your own time, kind of.
Manage your own time, mm-hmm. you know.
What did you actually take your degree in?
It was in business administration.
Okay. And why that?
I had begun building toward that in my other courses, so I just continued with that. And minored in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And business administration was just a broad general degree. It wasn't specific in any, you know, particular field. It's widely applicable.
Now, once you finished the degree, did that open up new opportunities
for
you?
Well, yeah, for retention because, you know, college degree was becoming a requirement to retain a commission in the United States Army. It was important, you know, to keep your commission, to continue service.
Absolutely.
And the Army was having all these riffs, you know, and, I mean, they were riffing West Point graduates even.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And going through those areas, there were two or three of those riffs.
So it was essential, really, for you.
And, you know, if you didn't get your college degree, surely you were going to be out, you know.
Uh-huh. What did the Army decide to do with you after you finished your degree?
When I finished my degree, they sent me to Panama.
Okay.
I worked in Panama, 193rd Infantry Brigade.
And what was your job?
There was I was a brigade assistant S3 for maybe a year, and I was assigned to the 3rd Battalion, 5th Infantry. I was the operations officer, you know, primary staff officer, responsible to the battalion commander for, you know, deploying troops and all that,
mm-hmm.
maintaining plans for operations there. And then after about 2 years in with the infantry brigade there and the infantry battalion, then I went over as a operations officer for the Jungle Warfare Center, which is another training command down there.
Is it its own command?
Huh?
Is the center is its own command?
Oh no, it belonged to the Southern Command. But it trained units in operating in jungles. It would bring units in from the states, give them jungle training. Of course, Vietnam was over by then. But we were still continuing. And it had been there before that, you know. It was just giving units jungle operation training experience in an actual jungle environment.
And as operations officer, what did you do?
Operations officer, you know, maintain the curriculum for foreign field operations, you know, write the scenarios,
uh-huh.
Or coordinate the movement of units in and out of there for school, that kind of stuff.
So this pulled out some of the things you had done earlier as
yeah.
an instructor in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I didn't actually get on and do any real teaching, but coordinate, you know, the schedule,
uh-huh.
set up the schedule, classrooms, class schedules and stuff like that.
Did this appeal to you?
Yeah. I enjoyed it. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed the environment around Panama, the tropical waters, the history of Panama.
Mm-hmm.
We traveled a lot. We did a lot of travel inland, outside the borders of the zone, you know, to learn more about it, see the country and mingle with the citizens and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and do things.
And actually, build a life enjoying living there.
Yeah.
And the opportunity
yeah.
of living there.
And, you know, with the family, raise a family there. Spent 4 years there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, family.
Did you have another kid by then, this time?
Yeah, well, I adopted three children.
Oh, really?
Also, okay. Yes.
Super. Great.
And we had one more, you know, besides the one child we lost earlier then
uh-huh.
in Panama, we had another baby.
Oh, so the family got pretty big then.
So we were four. We had four children.
That's super. And how did they do down in Panama?
They all loved it. I mean,
uh-huh.
They still remember the experience. Even the youngest one, he had 3 years there, and he can remember some things down there.
What an incredible opportunity for them.
Uh-huh. And they picked up, you know, Spanish language and everything.
That's really amazing.
So they did.
That's great.
They did real well. And we didn't confine ourselves. You know, a lot of people just confine themselves inside the zone, but we went out into the interior and, you know, visited, you know, nice places on the beach, nice places in the mountains, and spent nights out there. It did all kinds of stuff, so it was really pleasant.
How long did you actually stay down there then, 3 years?
Well, it was actually 4 years.
Okay.
Because what had happened then, too, is they ran into budgetary constraints, so that everybody's assignment, we were extended 1 year
mm-hmm.
to cut on PCS costs, you know, as a budget move.
Okay.
So I ended up putting 4 years in, which yeah. Didn't disappoint me at all.
I'll bet. It sounds
and,
like
no,
it.
No, that was a real nice assignment there. And, again, you know, and it was a small activity unit. Again, everybody was pretty familiar with each other.
You were there until 1976 then?
Until 1976 I came home.
Okay. And
came back to the States, back to Fort Benning.
Okay. and
you get old home,
yes.
Fort Benning.
What did they have you do then, sir?
Then I was assigned to the leadership department as an instructor. I got to stand on the stage and teach the elements of leadership and command, management, those kinds of subjects, strictly academic kind of.
And was that fun for you as well?
Yeah, in a way. It was challenging. Because
uh-huh.
it was a mental challenge because everybody has a different idea of what leadership and management actually is and how it's applied and that.
Uh-huh.
And there's no one style, you know. There's all kinds of different styles.
Did you stay at Fort Benning for another 2 years?
Or? Yeah, for, let me see, 2 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Of 1976... I left there in 1979, so 3 years.
And where did you go then?
Then I went to Fort Monroe, Virginia.
Okay. And what happened there?
At Fort Monroe's on the TRADOC staff, again, just as an assistant staff officer in the training department. Now, at this level, we were responsible for just core. I mean, I didn't write the curriculum for the various Army schools. But I was over infantry, so there was infantry school, OCS, ranger school.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of oversee that from a high level.
Putting it all together from a
yeah, central from that high level, what you have, how many people you're putting through. So it's mostly statistics, mostly paperwork. Subject matter, if it's driven by higher, you know, generals or whatever, I want this subject taught in this course. And if it really, you know, Mm-hmm. We have to push that down, make sure that went down to the school, got incorporated into the course.
Right. So a lot of meetings and a lot of...
A lot of talk. Most of it is just, you know, briefing talk. It wasn't actually leading any training or doing anything like that.
Now, at this point, you were nearing the end of 20 years.
Yeah. Okay. I was reaching near the end of my 20 years, yeah.
Okay. And I take it that you did actually leave the U.S. Army in 1983.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And what have you done subsequently, sir?
Since then, well, I left the Army, and I'm looking for civilian employment, mm-hmm. but because I left on their disability, I had a heart attack.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And so medically, I was medically retired.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Which was a shock because I wasn't ready for that. It wasn't like something I was planning. It just happened.
I see. Uh-huh.
And I really, you know, again, I wasn't ready to get out of the Army or anything, but I'd asked for reassignment in maybe another branch, and I was told I was being a lieutenant colonel at that point in time and having been trained infantry that, you know, I was too high level to change branches, you know, to try to retrain in a new field and all that. So it really wasn't cost effective.
You were too high up.
I was too high ranking, so so the best thing is, you know, just medically retire me.
Okay.
So
was that disappointing to you, sir?
Yeah, it was very disappointing.
Yeah.
It really
uh-huh.
was. So, you know, I came here and I tried to get some civilian employment, but because of my medical health and all that, it was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But a job opening occurred here at the Navy base under civil service, and I applied for it and was hired.
There in Jacksonville?
Here in Jacksonville at the Navy base.
Okay.
And, you know, my wife had family down here and everything, and we had decided that we'd like to live here, too, because mm-hmm. coming down to visit them and all, that this is a pretty nice area. So that kind of led us here.
And have you stayed in civilian employment?
And I've been in civil service since then. Yeah.
Of civil service?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
For the Navy, working for the Department of the Navy,
okay.
which was, that was a culture shock, because, you know, transferring from Army culture, now
uh-huh.
into Navy culture.
Uh-huh. can you talk about the differences? Just
oh,
in general
you know,
terms?
Yeah, just differences in terminology and philosophy, because the Navy, you know, they work on these ships, they're highly technical, everything is technical in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the Army, being infantry, you know, we kind of beat the bush and all that.
And figured out.
We get up
out.
Close and personal with
right.
the enemy. These guys shoot from miles and miles away, you know.
Yeah.
Equipment and weaponry is very high tech. You know, I'm involved with the laser target designating system for the F-18 aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of science involved in this.
Yes, sir. And how have you kind of updated your skills such that, you know, you're playing a part in?
Through schooling the Navy's had to offer, go to classes, learn about it through just on the job training.
Uh huh.
And just work myself, you know, get myself qualified in the position I'm in, which is really acquisition. I'm an acquisition specialist.
For the
F-18.
Okay.
Targeting systems.
Okay.
That means they're buying parts, you know, to keep that operational on board the aircraft and in the fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I like this job because having been retired, it actually brings me closer to a warfighter. Again, we're looking at a warfighter.
Right.
These pilots of these aircraft, you know, are the guys who carry the ordnance out there and dump it on the enemy.
Yes, sir.
And I'm involved in that to some degree here, you know. They buy the fuses or the cable connectors that
mm-hmm.
make the system work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
that's
I get
right.
to touch the airplanes. I get to talk to those guys and do a lot of stuff like that.
Do you talk about your experience in Vietnam very much?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I do. I relate some of those things. There's times I don't, but, you know, when we're talking like we are now,
mm-hmm.
bring up some points, and then that leads me to some other thoughts and, you know, stuff I had forgotten.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you just a couple of general questions. Have you seen any of the films that have been made about the Vietnam conflict, general release films?
Yeah, those commercial movies,
uh-huh.
like Apocalypse Now,
mm-hmm.
Platoon.
Right.
Yeah, I've enjoyed those. Yeah, I looked at them.
Yeah, you've enjoyed them?
Uh-huh.
Do they seem more or less realistic to you?
Platoon did.
Mm-hmm.
It portrayed scenes, you know, and experience. Of course, they stack them up, so these guys are, like, in combat every day for
right.
an hour. But,
right.
Yeah, but the experiences and all are something that we experienced one time or another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort
they
of
kind
rest.
Of portrayed all that. They just kind of jam them all together. Some of the situations, I think, were unrealistic.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of the brutality, where they reflect a lot of this brutality, and that didn't really occur. I mean, some did, but not on a scale that these things might lead you to believe it did.
Do you have any time to read any of the enormous number of books that have come out about Vietnam?
Yeah, I've read several.
Have any of them left an impression on you?
Yeah, one way or another. I don't know. You know, we were soldiers once and young.
Mm-hmm.
I never realized, you know, now my buddy Bob Taft, in that book is the first time I realized how he'd gotten killed.
Is that right?
I never asked exactly what happened. I knew he'd been killed, but, you know, it's one of those things you kind of put behind you and
yes,
you just don't look back on it, and you let it go. You live with it. Keep driving on. But when I opened that book and read, and I saw there's one chapter in there that's about Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Tells how he got killed and what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I realized that. And I think that brought some emotional feelings.
Yes, sir.
And I could see him as I was reading what his people around him said he was doing and all. And, I mean, I could picture Bob in Ranger training, you know,
mm-hmm.
and how and his mannerisms and his go-get-em kind of attitude, that I could see him doing that. And I realized, Bob, if you hadn't done that, maybe you wouldn't have got killed, you know.
Did you see the film that was
made? I watched the film, yeah. Of course, the film, the movie, We Were Soldiers, did not portray any of Bob's actions that I could tell.
It was sort of a composite.
That was kind of a composite.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, and I say it's a good movie because it reflects not just the courage of the 1st and the 7th Camp, but I think it reflects the courage of all the soldiers who found themselves in a hard time and fought. Of course, that happened to be the first, you know, real major battle of the war between American forces and North Vietnamese. But you know, the 7th Camp made a lot of mistakes there, too.
Like what?
Well, the movie doesn't portray it, but, you know, mm-hmm. tactically, I mean, they did some things. They stuck their neck out. They went beyond the artillery fire. They went
mm-hmm.
flying in there without artillery preps, you know, got in there.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less, like that movie portrayed Custer. If you read about Custer, he really, you know, he was trying to make a name for himself. He stretched his troops out, took them away from all their support, their main unit. You know, as he was hunting for the Indians, he had no idea where they were, how many there were. And he was hoping for some kind of major engagement that he could be victorious, come back, you know, and say, see how great I am.
Right.
And, you know, as a result, gets his unit, his regiment, which was the 7th Cav, too.
Yes.
Gets them pretty well decimated. And there's parallels, a lot of parallels there. Yeah, it was early in the war. These were commanders, eager commanders, wanting to engage the enemy. And as a result, I think they stretched it out a bit too far.
And but in your view, there were some heroic actions then too.
Definitely. I mean, the troops. You can't blame the troops. All they're doing is they're going into battle. I mean, the courage that the troops fought with, they're not belittling. But it's the decisions that were made at the division levels, the brigade levels,
mm-hmm.
that allowed this to happen, to get them in that position.
Right. Sir, did the experience of serving in Vietnam on two very long tours, very dangerous tours, affect your religious views at all?
Yeah, I think, no. I didn't find religion until about 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
When I was deeply depressed. I'd had more heart problems with my health.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I came to my knees before God truly accepted it. I don't think the war really did that. And I look back now, though, and I realize that there's something more than just my abilities that got me through that.
Yes, sir.
So.
Although I think your abilities did play some part.
Well, like I said, you know, it's there's more than that behind it. So.
Have you visited the wall in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How was that experience for you?
It's awe-striking
mm-hmm.
To look at all those names and impact that this whole thing sits in on you. And, of course, I go to those names, that the troops that I know, the Bob Tass particular, just touch it, you know. In memory, to look at the names of those men in my unit that died.
Sir, would you ever consider, or have you, in fact, already gone back to Vietnam?
No. I would like to do that. I don't know. It's expensive, but
right.
I would like to do that.
Why?
To stand on the ground that, you know, our troops died on, to be there, even to talk to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
We could reconcile. That's, you know, that's the religion coming out. But to reach back and say, you know, I'm sorry for what we did, you know, but maybe we should have done it. Because I know we were ruthless.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, if we're justified doing that or not, but, I mean, when we met him, we just dumped the world on him if we could get it.
Sir, is there anything else you'd like to add to this
interview? No, I can't think of anything else.
Okay. I want to thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
For participating.
Hopefully, you know, you can make good use of that.
Yes, sir. I think it will be used. Thank you very much.